Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us in another episode of Lid Publishing's podcast, Lid Radio. As always, my name is Miro, and I'll be your host for today's show. With me today is a returning guest. It is author Kevin Duncan. How are you today, Kevin?
Very fine, Miro. Thank you.
It's good to see you back on the show, and thanks for taking the time to join us today. And of course, for those listening, if you missed the last two episodes that we recorded with Kevin, you should definitely go back and check them out. We talked about the recent business bullshit book and some other very interesting topics for you to sink your teeth into. But today we have a very special episode on Lid Radio because we haven't done anything like this before, have we? And we're going to be talking about the Diagrams book, which was, fun fact, the first book within the Concise Advice series.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, yes. And we have a brand new edition this year to not only put the milestone on the Concise Advice series, but also put the milestone on the Diagram book being a bestseller. So for that very special occasion, Kevin has joined us today to talk a bit about the book, the inspiration behind it, and also we're actually going to be talking about the diagrams themselves. And we hope that you enjoy our conversation. But before we get into all of that, Kevin, what actually inspired you to write this book?
Yes, well, you're right. We've now got a fifth anniversary edition out. So that means that when I first thought about this, it was 6 or 7 years ago, something like that. And essentially what happened was that I do a lot of training, and there were sort of two joint things that I noticed. One was that when I put up diagrams to explain business issues, rather than just waffle on with words, I was getting what I thought was a good reaction from the attendees. But the other thing I noticed was that whereas in the past, if somebody does a talk or a lecture, people would do what you might call longhand notes that they're writing down to remember whatever it is that the speaker's saying. But I noticed in more and more that people were actually using little symbols and diagrams. So, for example, they might do a pyramid with an arrow pointing to a circle,
right,
or something
right.
like that. And they would regard that as helpful aide-mémoire to what the speaker was saying. And I thought, well, this is interesting because people are thinking in a different way. So I thought, I wonder how many diagrams I've got in all of my training materials. And the answer was 46. So I found four more and I wrote the 50 best diagrams in the world. And that's how it all started.
Great. And I've had the privilege of actually attending a workshop based around the diagrams within the book. I think it was a few years ago now in Waterstones, it was,
True,
in Piccadilly.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was very, very insightful. And it was great to see them in front of me and in action. So today what we're trying to do is kind of put that into a different perspective for our audience, and perhaps they can follow along and they can get all the value that I did when I was attending the lecture there, and then they can find out more in the book itself. So perhaps can you give us an overview of the different material within the Diagrams book, and then even some examples that we can go over?
Sure, yeah. Well, when I originally wrote the thing, I thought I'd organize these diagrams by shape. And I'm not really sure why I did that. I mean, it's been quite a long time ago. But I thought that was a way of doing it. So I had five sections with 10 diagrams in each, roughly clustered by triangles and pyramids, squares and axes, circles and pies, because there are quite a few of those, timelines and year views, and then flows and concepts, which are a bit more diffuse,
mm-hmm.
things like decision yeah. trees. And
do you have a favorite in any particular shape that sticks out for you? Everyone
well,
has a favorite, right?
Yeah, I do like Venn diagrams with overlapping components, particularly where there are more than two of them, because they often enable people to work out how two or three factors interreact and how they work. But to be honest with you, they've pretty much taken on a life of their own.
Right.
And so really, it's not so much the shapes, it's what topics you populate them with and how you use them. And that's where it gets fun.
Absolutely. And in your work, what have been the most usual topics or themes that have presented themselves as you've done various workshops and work on your own with them?
Yes, so the market map, which is essentially one vertical axis and one horizontal axis, which gives you four quadrants, is probably one of the most powerful and readily used things. And people find this really helpful to organize their thinking because they haven't really thought about their business issues other than in words. Of course, the irony doesn't escape me that we are doing an audio interview about a visual thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And now let's get on to that, because now that we've started talking about the various diagrams and you've given us your type of favorite ones, can you perhaps give us some of the original diagrams within the very first edition that were kind of the ones sticking out and the ones you thought were the standing out favorites in there?
Yeah, well, one of my favorites is a thing I call the whittling wedge. And whittling is an interesting word, because actually when I train internationally, there are a lot of people who do not have English as their first language, who don't know what whittling is.
I don't know what it is myself, to be completely
right,
honest.
Right, there we go. So essentially it's taking a sharp knife and taking a stick and creating a point a bit like a pencil. So you are whittling off the material that you don't want to create a sharp point. So my whittling wedge is essentially a wedge. So on the left-hand side, the line, the vertical line is high, and down to the right, it disappears to nothing. So it's a lopsided triangle. And the most effective thing we use this for is to help people to work out how to make their proposals and lines of argument make sense to people and to tell their story. So roughly speaking, to the left, you've got a high line, lots of options, typically 10 things. But that's no help to the person that you're presenting your proposal to, because there's too much of it and it's too confusing and they don't know what you're proposing. At the far other side, at the pointy end, often when people present their proposals, they just say, well, this is it and here it is.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of people who hear that, as it were, line of argument, they don't know what the thinking was beforehand. The presenter hasn't shown their workings at all. And often the person listening to it thinks, well, maybe they've only got one idea, or they're quite stubborn and they're just telling me I've got to do the one thing, but surely there must be other options. So in the whittling wedge, we start with lots of possibilities on the left-hand side, explain our workings, like in good GCSE maths, and then arrive at an answer. So we're both open-minded and decisive in the same line of argument.
Oh, that sounds fascinating, because as anyone who's recently ventured into the internet will tell you, making an argument can be the most intimidating thing that you can do on there. So, you know, for our listeners, if you want to go on those, you know, YouTube comment sections and, you know, your business proposals or you're trying to pitch, take the whittling edge and go with it, and you will have great success.
Yeah, so that's... it's a real favourite that crops up all the time in training. There's a close cousin of it, which I call the bow tie. Now, everybody can picture a bow tie, but having described to you the whittling wedge, you can imagine one side of the bow tie on the left, if you like, starting broad with its thinking and then whittling down. And if you imagine the knot of the bow tie as the ta-da type of moment, which you often get in presentations where people have gone on for 20 minutes about their stuff and they say, and now here's the big thing, the big proposal. Now, the interesting thing is that in so many presentations, the presenter thinks that that moment is going to be amazing and that they're going to get round of applause from the audience and all this sort of stuff. But actually in business, it really rarely happens. And sometimes it's even worse than that, because that moment is actually something of a letdown and it goes flat. So on the right-hand side of the bow tie, the other wing, what we're using this diagram for is to explain to people making their line of argument that they shouldn't dwell too long on the centre knot of the bow tie, and they should rapidly expand back out to allow what is usually a broad audience to understand the fertility of the idea that's being proposed. Now, typically in the age of procurement, this will mean that people can, as it were, take a tick box of criteria and say, aha, I've had this idea explained to me now, I understand how it came about, and now I'm being explained all the fertile ways it can be used in order to fulfill the commercial needs.
All right, in a way it is narrowing down the argument and at the same time answering any potential questions that might be coming up during.
Yep.
And I think also it would narrow down any potential feedback straight after a presentation, as you often will have some very picky executive or manager that is just ready to take it down the moment they get the chance.
That's true.
So just don't let them do that.
Don't let them do that.
And get the bow tie tied, essentially.
That's it. Yes, yeah. Okay. My third favourite, I think, from the original book is the one I call the Central Idea Satellite System. So to describe this to listeners, if you imagine quite a large blob in the middle of the chart, like the planet Jupiter, it's quite large, and then around it goes, say, about half a dozen satellites, smaller planets. Now, each of these planets, as it were, is empty because it just has a line round it, and what you're trying to do is fill your ideas into each of the circles. So the big central one, that's your central idea. It's a big theme and it should be very fertile. And what usually happens is you say, this is my central idea or strategy, and then number one, satellite, here is an example of how it can manifest itself or be shown as an execution, a tactic, an example of. And that sounds easy enough. But where it gets complicated or difficult to do, if you like, is where you say, well, yes, I've got one idea like that. Now, here's my second satellite. And then when you try to fill in the third, often you think, I can't think of one.
Right.
And now, if that's true, that means that the person who originated the central idea has to self-confess that actually this idea is not as fertile as they thought it was. So they need to cross out the idea in the middle and think of a better one that's more potent, because if they can't think of quite a few examples of how it will manifest itself, then it's not that strong an idea.
Wow, that is that is actually a fascinating way of putting it, and I guess it would be an asteroid straight to the planet core in that way, which I guess we would want to avoid. So these have been kind of the originals, kind of the old school guys that have really taken the book, you know, to the next level. But for our listeners, as we release the new best selling edition of the Diagrams book, we have included more material, and there's a fair number of new diagrams. So can you perhaps run us through with some of them and how you came up with them as well?
Yeah, happily. So it was interesting when I first produced the book, because of course if you come up with an idea for a book, at that stage you have no feedback whatsoever about whether the theme is any good. So you talk to a publisher, you take a leap of faith, you do the thing, and obviously you're passionate about the stuff, so you think, I hope this connects. I really, really honestly did not know that when I produced this book, I suddenly discovered afterward, because of the reaction I got, that there's a whole world market in visual thinking. And so there are millions of people around the world who think more in shapes and pictures than they do verbally.
Right.
And this thing now has been translated into over a dozen languages, and it's really
quite... Yes, correct.
Yeah, and it's fascinating the countries that decide to take it. So first up were countries like Japan and Korea and China. So suddenly there was a whole Eastern market. Anyway, without boring you too much, the net result is that with a mixture of that feedback coming in and me training people, and people then send me stuff, plus I read a lot. So when you add all that up together, there's almost a sort of continuous supply of new ways of doing diagrams. So to answer your question, one of my favourites from the new material is a thing I call the ambivert arc. Now, this, if your listeners wanted to picture it, just picture a rainbow. So it's down at the bottom on the left-hand side and on the far right-hand side, and it's got a nice curvy arc to it.
Right.
Okay. Now, the axis on the bottom, on the left-hand side, you've got introverts. And on the right-hand side, far right, you've got extroverts. And the vertical axis is the amount of money that they account for when they sell. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Now, if you ask the average person, who do you think sells more? Extroverts or introverts?
They'll take the extroverts.
And they'll take the extroverts.
Yeah.
But what the arc shows, and it's from a study at Wharton University by a guy called Adam Grant, is that fascinatingly, yes, of course, introverts who are so shy that they don't say a thing don't sell anything at all or very much. But equally, extroverts who are so outgoing and really annoy people and pester them and talk too much and don't listen, they don't sell much either. And so in the middle, the sweet spot or optimum blend, if you like, is to take on the qualities of, and this is a real word, an ambivert. And an ambivert can either be somebody who is more inclined to being introverted but can turn on a little burst of sales skill.
When required,
right? Or, equally importantly, an extrovert who's inclined to talk too much and sell too hard, if they can just listen more and tone it down, either of those meeting in the middle, and that's why I call it an ambivert arc, and it's really helpful to people of all types.
Right, and this is the second word I've learned just in today's podcast. So as you see, there is learning happening in motion. I was trying to picture the rainbow as you were explaining it, and to be honest, it makes perfect sense. And of course, we've had various guests on talking about stuff like sales and the different approaches you can take. And I think universally, it always has been, you can't just go one way. It's really difficult. Yeah. And of course, people are way too varied and diverse to fall into one category exclusively. And what can happen is perhaps you may have a one-off hit, perhaps it clicks sometimes, but to have a steady performance which delivers results consistently, it's a bit of a yin and yang, I'd say. And as long as you mix the two, that it'd work out.
Yeah. So that's a nice one. I also like one which I call barcode day. Now, we can all picture a barcode as it appears on essentially every product that you buy these days.
I have one on the back of my neck.
You have one? Do you really?
No.
So if you picture this thing, you can envisage that it's a series. It appears to be oblong, broadly speaking, but it appears to be made up of a series of very, very thin slices. And so a barcode day, if you imagine that the far left-hand side of it is 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, whenever you start your stuff, and on the far right is 5 or 6, or whenever you finish your stuff, this is a visual metaphor for a day in which the individual is perpetually interrupted. And it's really fascinating. Now, they did a study at Microsoft of 40,000 employees, and they asked them, when you're involved doing something but you get interrupted, on average, how long does it take you to get back to doing what you were doing? And the answer was 12 to 15 minutes, which means that if you're interrupted more than four times an hour, you've lost your entire career.
Wow.
Right. Now, so if you talk to any modern executive, they will empathize with the barcode visual. And they will say, yes, that's my day, and I'm constantly being interrupted, and that's why I can't get anything done. And so we then look at how to chunk up time in far more productive ways, particularly because multitasking is now proven not to work, because there's a switching cost between each task, and you lose energy and focus every time you do
it. I'm glad we've come to that conclusion, the way. I mean, I'm very proud to admit that multitasking is not something I can do. And multitasking in the purest sense, not as if, you're typing something and you're listening to music. That isn't multitasking.
That's not the same thing.
But in the purest sense, I find it to be something extremely difficult, and often results end up being poorer because you can't concentrate on the thing that you're really trying to do. And especially in my area, which is IT, as they say, one line in the code and, well, it goes wrong.
It's gone.
So, I absolutely agree on that point.
Yeah. So for us, people like you and me, Mira, I invented rapid sequential tasking.
Oh.
Okay. Which means you can still get things done fast and efficiently, but you start a thing, you finish it. You start a thing, you finish it. Take a breather, go again, and so forth. Do not have 15 things on the go, all started but not finished. Good doesn't work.
Yeah, I absolutely agree on that.
Do you want more?
Well, actually, before we move on, there's something about this one that really did resonate with me, and that's, well, we know this is happening, and there's a lot of evidence to show for this. In your sort of professional experience, do you have any feedback in terms of how we can possibly fix this time issue and this disruption issue for the executive level managers out there, and even those who are experiencing this on a daily basis?
Yes, it's extremely difficult, and it's getting worse. I do actually collect statistics on what degree of pressure people are under, and it really is getting worse. In fact, I think there was a survey even last week, it was probably one of yours that went round, showing that there are even people now getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning so worried and doing their email and all this sort of stuff.
Being unable to fall asleep,
Yeah, it's insane. There's so many aspects to it. There's a lot of science. And all the microwaves from these machines, the light emitted by mobiles, iPads and so forth, they one way or another, they all interrupt sleep patterns. So that in itself is pretty disastrous. People are being asked to do more and more. I remember 10 or 15 years ago, it was predicted that in 10 years or so, email would be dead because everybody would be using messaging platforms and so forth.
Right.
That clearly hasn't happened. It's got worse. And executives essentially just keep doing more and more. And the last survey I read showed that in the UK, the average executive delivers an extra 24 days of work for their company than their contract suggests.
That's absolutely staggering.
Yeah. So that's essentially 5 weeks of holiday or more than a 13th month of labour done. And it's all done after work in the week and over the weekend when people do their extra work there. And then, of course, the divorce rate goes up because it ruins all the relationships.
Yeah.
You say, well, he was permanently on email. So the whole thing's a bit of a disaster. I haven't really answered your question, but for example, it's the very least I can recommend to all the people who attend my training is you really, really owe it to yourself to liberate a minimum of 5 or 10 minutes each day, probably at the beginning of each day, but it might suit if you do it at the end, to just pause and think, what am I doing and why am I doing it? There are one or two, well, there are lots, but different sort of mantras that you can use. But MIT is most important thing. And many a chief exec will say, right, if I just do one thing really well today, then I will have had a big bearing on my team, the company, the share price, the whatever it may be. And sometimes the one thing is better. Now, there is a diagram, actually, that's in the new material, which is relevant to this, and it's the essentialist one. And here we're asking people to picture two circles of identical size. But the one on the left has emanating from it a whole series of tiny, tiny arrows, very short arrows, all round, 12 of them, 20 of them. And that, if you like, symbolises the 27 things that you're going to do today. But the other one, the circle's the same size, but it has emanating from it just one long directional arrow, just the one. And in an ideal world, the long direction there, it actually only takes the same amount of energy. So if you add up all the fizzing around of the bits and pieces, but turn it into one clear thing, then that is the way that you should be working, and they call it essentialism. So that's my broad advice.
Yeah, of course, and I think 27 might not even be enough arrows.
It might not be enough arrows.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's do some more if you have some prepared for us, because this is all fascinating and it's actually interesting to see it feeding into just daily business life. And of course, I think it can very well be applied to personal life as well.
Yeah, that thing about overload, there's a thing you can do which they call a reverse pilot. Now, everyone knows what a pilot is. You think of an idea and you do it and you see if it works, and if it does, you do it more. But in a reverse pilot, you look at all the stuff you're doing and you question whether something's worth doing. And for a test period, you remove it.
Yeah.
You don't do it.
Doing the dishes. Forget it. Well, I mean, doing the washing up.
So much in business.
Yeah.
It's not worth doing. And as clients and customers pile more and more onto companies, there's just this endless pile of stuff.
Yes.
Now, typically in a team, there will be a lot of material that arguably doesn't need doing. So, for example, status reports. It's a classic that every Friday the account executive on a team rushes around collecting all this information, puts it all together and sends it out to 35 people, only to discover that no one actually reads it.
Yeah.
So what's the point of that? So you would actively identify these things and remove them from the system if you possibly could, and then people get less to do, that is pointless.
Yeah, that is a great example. Yeah. And actually, there is one particular diagram that I want to ask you about.
Oh, yeah.
And I love it because the name itself just speaks volumes, and that's the don't be a dick flowchart.
Ah, yes.
Now, that is my personal favorite one on the name alone. Can you perhaps elaborate on what that is? Because I think it's very important.
Yeah, this is great. This was originally sent to me by one of my daughters.
Ah, right.
And this is an example where people send me things and sometimes they are hilarious. And there's some really clever people around who invent this stuff. So this is a flow diagram. And as you know, in a flow diagram, there's a box that leads to an arrow which goes round. And it's a question then of whether that is a circuit and you can go back round again where you came from. So this has a very, very simple question in the middle of box in the center of the diagram, and it says, "Are you being a dick?" And out of that flows two arrows. One says no, and then the next box along says, "Excellent, carry on."
Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, yeah. And the other one, of course, says, "Yes, I am being a dick." And the next box says, "Don't be a dick." And then and then you go back into the area.
Well, there you go.
And that's,
yeah.
You can't get simpler than that. Repeat ad infinitum.
Yeah, and you should get some second opinion as well, you know, get it checked, because I think there might be strong bias on that one.
Yes.
Great. I think we can round off with one final one, just to keep the number.
Yeah. What should we do next? Well, there's one I like called the ideal team player. And this comes from a guy called Patrick Lencioni. I've been calling him for years Patrick Lencioni, but then I saw a video of him talking and he calls himself Lencioni. And this is interesting to me because it's trying to identify the characteristics that make people really good team players, classically at work. And he gets it down to three criteria: being humble, being hungry to get on and do stuff, and then the word he uses is smart, which I should just clarify doesn't mean intellectually intelligent like astrophysicists. It means emotionally smart, so that you're intelligent enough to get on with other people well and judge situations. Okay, so that's humble, hungry and smart. And so what you've got here is essentially a triple Venn diagram, three circles with an overlapping bit in the middle. And if someone has all three of those in good measure, then they're going to be an excellent team player. But where it gets quite interesting for me is to work out, well, what happens if they've only got two of these qualities or one, okay? So let's start with if they've only got one.
Right.
And they're easier to spot.
They're just hungry.
They're just hungry. So, for example, the just hungry person is called the bulldozer, because they just want to succeed. They've got no emotion, intelligence and no humility, so they just steamroll.
Yeah, no empathy, there's just nothing there.
So you can spot them a mile off. Someone who is only humble, he calls the pawn, because they haven't really got the desire and they sort of do what they're told, but they're a little bit awkward sometimes, and so they don't have the emotional intelligence to bond really well with other people. And then the people who are just smart, he calls the charmer. So someone who's really charming. So, oh, everybody loves Dave. Everybody loves Dave. But he's got no ambition, really, and not really no humility. Yeah. So that's, those are easy-ish to spot.
Take it down a bit, Dave. I mean,
take it down, Dave, know, exactly. Yeah. Where it gets, to my mind, much more interesting and complicated is where, if you can imagine these three circles overlapping, there are three little bits there where people have got two of these characteristics. So someone who is humble and hungry, he calls the accidental messmaker, because they're quite keen to get stuff done, and there's ambition there for sure, and they're humble, but they don't have the emotional intelligence to realise when they're actually just creating a bit of trouble around the office, actually.
Right, yeah.
That's what he calls them, the accidental messmaker. Then when you combine being humble with being emotionally intelligent but not much ambition, he calls it the lovable slacker. Okay, now the lovable slacker, you know, it's personal. Well, they never quite finish the work. It's always a bit late and so on, but they're not arrogant, so we really like them. So
we just let it go. I mean, it's
go,
okay.
Right?
Yeah,
they haven't got
okay.
much ambition. And then I think arguably the least sort of favourable combination of two qualities is being ambitious, hungry, and being emotionally intelligent, but having no humility. So that's hungry and smart, which they call the skillful politician.
Or a sociopath.
Or a sociopath.
Or it could be either one. I mean, it's hard to tell.
So with, you can immediately see that with a system like that, sorry, it took a little while to go through, but it immediately shows you that almost nobody who runs a team can resist those empty Venn diagrams and saying, right, I'm now going to fill my people in there because I'm going to put them into types and get a shape up of whether my team is going to work or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating stuff there. And I think on that last diagram, I'd like to leave it off there. And
sure.
Of course, for our audience, if you enjoy the different diagrams and themes and ideas that we talked about in this episode, Links in the description below will be there where you can find out more about the Diagrams book, as we've talked about, in over 12 languages now translated out there. Yeah, and you know, in its special edition print. So please do go out there and pick it up, and you'll be able to apply the same diagrams to your life. And of course, thank you very much, Kevin, for taking the time to join us today. I know it was a busy schedule for you this week.
Thanks very much.
And it's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And of course, if you like to get in touch with Kevin and reach out to him and perhaps give some feedback on today's podcast or just have a conversation, there will be links in the description below to social media profiles and, of course, expert advice and his travel blog, which I know he updates quite regularly with some great content on there.
I do.
So please check it out. And lastly, of course, I would like to thank you, the audience, very much for joining us this week on the podcast. It's always a great pleasure to have you with us, and your support is greatly appreciated. Well, I look forward to seeing you on next week's show, and take care.